The printed page is supposed to be living on borrowed time with smartphones and other e-readers. Why would anyone want to read text on paper and have to turn pages and all that? The demise of printed matter has been predicted many times and still has not happened. In fact, paper books have had a mild resurgence in recent years. We learn that and more in a new book by Leah Price called What We Talk About When We Talk About Books, subtitled The History and Future of Reading. Leah Price is a professor of English at Rutgers University, the State University in New Jersey. She's the founder of the Initiative for the Book at Rutgers, which is just getting started with the fall term there. Leah Price, welcome to The Exchange.
Thank you for having me.
Safe to say, then, that you're a big believer in books and their value to us?
I am a big believer in books, but I am not a big believer in nostalgia for the book imagined as a symbol of the good old days, as opposed to evil modern technologies such as the radio show on which you and I are talking right now.
It's funny you mention it that way, because one of the intros I had considered and discarded was the idea that, well, of course, newspapers were there for a while, then radio killed the newspapers, and then TV killed the radio, and then the internet killed TV. And it doesn't quite work that way, does it?
Here we are.
Right. Talking about books on the radio. Leah, one of my favorite jokes is the one about the second book coming off Gutenberg's press being about the demise of publishing, which tells us the warning's been coming for a long time, hasn't it?
I think that every time readers notice the book changing, they imagine that that means that the book is dying, when in fact, precisely what has made the book such a resilient form is its flexibility and its ability to adapt to changing times.
Flexibility in what sense?
Well, we tend to think of the book as a single thing that has been stable for around half a millennium since, as you say, Gutenberg. But books have taken so many different forms during those roughly five centuries. Some books have been sold in the way that we tend to imagine books being sold, for hard cash, over the counter, in a bookstore. But for a lot of that period, the normal way for books to be sold would have been by subscription. And for a lot of that period, most books were not read silently by someone curled up under a tree like that person in the Kindle icon, but were read aloud to a group of strangers in the pub. Books have been unbelievably, or rather, publishers and booksellers have been unbelievably inventive about constantly developing new ways to get books into the hands of readers, so that books were the first good to be sold on consumer credit. Books were one of the first commodities to be displayed on browsable open shelves that buyers could actually pick objects off of and flick through themselves rather than kept behind the counter. And books were also, in the 20th century, one of the first goods to be subject to sophisticated electronic inventory control, such as the ISBN and the barcode, which is one reason why when Jeff Bezos was looking for a guinea pig to test out this crazy new crackpot idea of selling things online, he chose books to test out this idea. Because, as the media historian Ted Strippas points out, books were easy to keep track of.
Huh. So I always wondered why Bezos started with books, and it's something that had been tracked that way for a long time then.
Yeah, so books, if you think about it, books are compared to most kinds of widgets. They're standardized in shape. They're easy to mail. They're easy to pack. To some extent, they're easy to quantify. They're made in multiples. They are of a relatively standardized shape, if you exclude children's books that are shaped like parallelograms or fuzzy discs. And so the book has, in a sense, driven new technologies and driven new business models, rather than providing the sort of cozy retreat from modernity that today in the digital era we sometimes take the printed book to symbolize. This is one reason why it drives me crazy when my local library talks about the possibility of having a technology-free reading room. I love getting away from my cell phone. I love curling up in a comfortable beanbag where the library patron sitting next to me is not yakking away on their phone. But I don't think that should be called a technology-free zone, because books are the or technology.
In other words, it's not the technology, it's the stuff that we're using the technology to access, the ideas in words.
Exactly. And that is a big debate within the field of book history, as in many areas of the history of technology. How far are we talking about an object as opposed to a set of human practices that happen to be enabled or prompted by that object? And putting it the other way around, how far is a book simply a kind of convenient bucket that ferries ideas from the mind of an author to the mind of a reader? And how far is it an object that is interesting in its own right?
Some interesting stuff right in the beginning of the book, Leah, where you point out that e-books did pass paper books at one point, but it looks like they got passed again.
That's right. It looked, among other things, it looked for a while as if dedicated e-readers were going to be the device of the future. That at least is what Amazon wanted us to believe in the early days of the Kindle, and yet all of the statistics available right now suggest that electronic reading, by and large, is happening on devices made for other activities. So in the U.S. and in much of East Asia, people read on their phones. In a lot of parts of Europe, people read on their laptops. The one device on which, by and large, people are not reading is a dedicated e-reader, such as a Kindle.
Interesting. So the device that was meant to be just for reading is the one that people don't care about. It's got to do other stuff as well.
Well, exactly. And of course, the challenge that raises is that if you're reading what I call long-form literary print, so something like a novel or a collection of poems, on a device that can also access your Instagram account and your calendar and your texting, it becomes harder to resist the temptation to switch screens for just a second. But this, again, is not a problem having to do with the physical device itself. In the early days of the electronic book, people talked a lot about whether the screen was too twitchy or too shiny or too little or too big. There was that famous line from the novelist Annie Proulx, "No one is going to sit down and read a novel on a twitchy little screen ever." Well, it turns out, with the wisdom of hindsight, that people are plenty willing to read novels on twitchy little screens. And in fact, in Japan, a whole genre has developed called the cell phone novel, that is novels composed thumb stroke by thumb stroke on twitchy little screens and read on twitchy little screens by strap hangers on the subway. So the device is not a problem. What is a problem, as it always has been, I think, is carving out time to read when you're not tempted to do something else.
Is that why people romanticize the physical book, you think, the paper book, the idea of, curling up with a good book? And because, as you point out, this is more nostalgia than anything else, because it wasn't like people really had the time to do that in the past.
Well, people have had time to do that at certain times and places in the past. It's true that for most of the history of printing, first of all, as we know, the vast majority of human beings were not literate. Secondly, the vast majority of human beings worked backbreakingly long hours and did not have disposable time to read. And even if they did have disposable time, it was likely to be after working hours at night without a cheap, reliable, and non-inflammable source of illumination. So one kind of print reading that we tend to be very nostalgic for these days is reading in bed, and yet reading in bed is actually a fairly recent invention because as long as you are using some kind of open flame as the enabling condition for reading after the sun goes down, you run a very high risk of setting the bed on fire. So the history of reading has as much to do with infrastructures, with changing infrastructures, as with the changing forms of the book itself, with things like electric lighting, and especially with successive transportation technologies. Because the one time when people have consistently had dead time in which it was hard enough to do other things that it was easy to get absorbed in a book or other piece of printed matter was during their commute. That is also relatively recent in the sense that as long as you're commuting on some form of horse-powered vehicle, that ride is going to be pretty bumpy and you are going to get nauseous. So one of the really important developments in the history of reading was in the history of finding time for reading was the emergence of railroads in the 19th century, because you've got a smooth ride, you've got decent illumination, and you've got, for people living in the new suburbs that sprung up along with commuter rail lines in this country, you've got a chunk of time in which you can't really do any profitable work, but you're bored out of your mind if you don't do anything. And that is one sense in which I do think, I do buy nostalgia for the era before cell phones, because there are fewer and fewer stretches of dead time on the train, at the doctor's office, waiting in line, when we are so bored that it occurs to us to reach for that book in our pocket.
Leah Price is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, professor of English at Rutgers University and a book historian. Her own book is called What We Talk About When We Talk About Books, The History and Future of Reading. There's a great line, and well, quite a few good lines of the book, actually, Leah, but one in particular grabbed my eye. Show me how you want to read, and I'll show you who you want to be. What does that mean?
I think that when we idealize the book, we are idealizing the self who we want to be. We imagine that if we only put down our phone and picked up our paperback, we would be more patient, more focused, more absorbed, more imaginative, more empathetic, maybe even kinder. And of course, there is some social scientific evidence to back up this hunch. There's the Canadian study that I talk about in the book that shows that people who read for pleasure are likelier to vote, volunteer, or do a favor for a neighbor. And there's that other study that shows that people who read what I call long-form literary print are less likely to get divorced. That said, if you had asked any clergyman or doctor in the 19th century what the effects of long-form literary reading, of reading novels and poems is, they would have said, look at Madame Bovary. You read too much. You don't, you know, not only do you not stay married, reading a lot of long-form literary print drives you to adultery, debt, and suicide. So I think our current idealization of the book really flips on its head an older set of fears about the moral and medical effects of print reading.
There were times in history when people worried about books the same way that we worry about people with their electronic devices now, wasn't there? Were people worried that people looking down at books might walk into things and get hit by horses and stuff?
Well, exactly. So the same worries about distractibility, the same worries about wasting time, and the same worries about, especially in both cases with teenagers, or with young women in particular, the fear that people's moral fiber is going to be sapped if they spend too much time living in a virtual universe vehicled by these devices into which people can retreat. So the irony, as you say, is that the books, which used to be seen as the disease, are now coming to be seen as the cure at every digital detox where you lock up your phone and without a copy of War and Peace. So one thing that I think has emerged in an interesting way over the past few years in American culture is this phenomenon of the book as not smartphone, the book, the printed book as a kind of stick with which to beat digital culture.
But as you point out a fair amount in the book, it's not, what we're talking about is the conveyance, the book or the e-book is still something that shapes dark spaces onto light spaces in the form of letters that make sense to our brains.
Right. And in that sense, from some vantage points, the e-book looks very continuous with the printed book, beginning with the fact that they are both media that have allowed both manufacturers and marketers to develop extremely creative ways to get a sequence of words from point A to point B. From a different vantage point, of course, books are much more of a single-use kind of object. On a smartphone, long-form reading is only one of many things that you can do. In a printed book, you could say the main function of the book is to be read. That said, there are many kinds of printed book for which that is not true. When people are nostalgic for printed books in the olden days, they are very rarely expressing nostalgia for the telephone book. And yet, if 15 years ago you had done a survey of what book was most commonly owned by Americans, it would have been probably the Bible and the Yellow Pages.
We are talking to Leah Price here on the Jefferson Exchange. She's a professor of English at Rutgers University and a book historian, and she's written her own book called What We Talk About When We Talk About Books, The History and Future of Reading. You can join the conversation on the Exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So here again, you know, we're forced to think from your lessons in the book about books as physical objects, conveyance for the ideas contained within. Talk about some of the exercises you give to your book history classes.
Yeah, those are fun, and I wish that there were a way of doing one on the radio. So on the first day of class, I usually ask, when I'm teaching undergraduates, I usually ask for one volunteer who's willing to be blindfolded, and then ask that student to stumble as best they can over to the nearest bookshelf. I teach in a library, and pull down a book from the shelf and take a set of 20 questions from the other students in the class to help the blindfolded student see how much they can figure out about the book just from touching it without actually looking at the book. And this is a way really to short circuit our unfortunate obsession with reading books. We tend to think of a book as something that can be apprehended only through the eyes. We read it, or in the case of certain books, we look at the pictures, we look at the layout. But don't try this at home. Don't try this now, listeners, if you are listening to the radio in your car. But if you are someplace where it is safe to do this, close your eyes, reach out if you have a book near you, and start feeling that book the way that you could feel another human being's body in the dark. Feel its spine. Open it. Feel whether the pages are crisp or limp. Feel where the pages are crisp and where the pages are limp, because it may not surprise you to find out that in the vast majority of books, in the vast majority of the world's libraries, the pages toward the beginning of the volume are a little bit sticky, a little bit sweaty, a little bit loose in the binding, and a little bit limp to the touch. And as you progress through the book, those pages crisp up until usually at the end of the book, they are so pristine that you could give yourself a paper cut with them. So one thing that books as physical objects can tell us is how users in the past, how previous readers have navigated their way through the text. The tactile feeling of a book can provide the analog equivalent of the digital heat map that tells us what parts of an electronic book have been most often read or annotated, where readers' eyeballs have lingered the longest.
Wow, that's amazing. The things you can learn from looking at a book. I want to come back to the contents of books, though, because you really had me laughing when you talked about pairing your reading with laundry cycles. What was that about?
People of my generation, and this will date me, who used to go to the laundromat and know that they were going to be stuck in that laundromat for 20 minutes or 30 minutes, depending on whether they were doing a delicate wash or an extra spin cycle, you know, would often bring a book that they had timed for exactly that amount of reading. And I think one skill that has been lost in the era of the smartphone is the hunch for what size hunk of printed bound wood pulp will last you at the laundromat, or how many books to take on a flight of a certain number of hours duration. We used to be very good at guessing that. Now that I always have a smartphone in my pocket, the same way I always have a granola bar in my pocket, I no longer have that atavistic fear of being caught without enough to eat or caught without enough to read if the plane gets delayed on the runway.
Interesting. But either way, when we're talking about, either commuting as we did before about, you know, flights across the country or laundry cycles, I mean, the fact is that even when we romanticize the days we had time to read, it was because we were just stuck doing nothing else because we had to wait for something.
Well, yeah. And the great 20th century French writer Georges Perec said once that the subway is the library of the people. There's a wonderful blog called Underground New York Public Library that shows images of paperbacks or hardbacks swaying back and forth in people's hands as they ride the New York subway. And it's true that with every encroachment of Wi-Fi, in every new space where for the first time we're getting cell phone service, you can see the paperbacks beginning to dwindle, because reading thrives on dead time. Reading is a crime of opportunity cost. And you can see this not just in terms of the places and times where individuals read, but also in terms of the demographics of reading.
We just talked about reading being something of a crime of opportunity when you aren't doing anything else or stuck waiting for something. It's a great time to read a book. You were starting to talk about the demographics of reading when we took the break.
Right. So why is it that American women who earn 83 cents or whatever it is now on the dollar nonetheless spend more money on books than do American men? And that imbalance is even more pronounced if you look at who uses public libraries in the United States. For centuries now, reading has clustered among groups that have time to read. So retired people read a lot. Children read a lot. Women read a lot. And that would seem to suggest that the higher your wage earning potential, the less you read, because if I can simplify very crudely, the opportunity cost of spending time reading rather than spending time in salaried employment is highest for middle-aged men. And this is, this is obviously a complicated statistic in that, for one thing, more than many other commodities, books are often bought by someone who is not the end user. So a lot of books are bought as gifts. Book sales traditionally peak right before Christmas. So the fact that women are buying more books doesn't exactly correlate with how many more books women are reading. And likewise with library borrowing, that practice is particularly high among parents of young children. So that, too, may explain some of the gender imbalance in library borrowing. But it does seem clear that in the developed world right now, reading is the province of those whose time lacks value. This is not at all true in the developing world, where girls' literacy continues to lag behind boys' literacy because it is expensive to send your child to school and you decide who to invest in.
Wow. So interesting. So are girls also working more in the developed world? I mean, are they expected to do the household chores in ways that boys are not?
Right. So that's a different kind of opportunity cost. But one very clear trend is that gap is narrowing in many parts of the world, as indeed it narrowed in Europe a couple of centuries ago as women's literacy began slowly to catch up with men's. And now, of course, in book reading, women read significantly more books than men. Women read somewhat more books and magazines than men, but for periodicals, the gap is much smaller than it is for books.
So we were just talking about male-female demographics and to some degree some economic income levels as well. There's great detail in here about, for example, back in the 19th century, who could afford to buy newspapers fresh and then how they sort of moved economically from that point.
Right. So this is something that maybe you could think of as analogous to whether you have the free or the premium subscription to some app. Newspapers were so expensive until the emergence of cheap wood pulp paper in the 19th century, because paper made out of linen rags is very expensive. And so until the second half of the 19th century, most newspapers were not single-use objects as we think of them today, where you read the paper on the bus and then leave it on the seat and then get a new newspaper the next day. Newspapers were usually subscribed to by a relatively wealthy person. That person would then sell it on to someone slightly less wealthy who would be paying less for the paper but would be getting their news a few hours old, and that person would then sell it on to someone else, and it would make its way down a whole chain of users until eventually it would be bought for cheap or given away for nothing to some working class person who would read it aloud, often to other listeners who were not literate but were interested in politics at the pub, and eventually the paper would make its way even further down that chain to people possibly not literate at all who would use it to wrap food or to cut out patterns or to wad the chinks in a broken window.
Wow. We have to think about the ways in which you use printed matter that had nothing to do with actually reading this stuff on them.
Right, and because this is a family station, I'm not talking about the other use of old newspaper that most of us probably know, but as a result of this kind of chain of handing down, it seems clear that before the era of cheap paper began in the second half of the 19th century, most people had a very finely grained sense of the texture and the heft and the absorbency of different kinds of paper. So I talk about one street seller of vegetables in 19th century London who had very strong opinions about which was the best newspaper. And what defined the best newspaper for him wasn't what the political angle of the different daily papers was. It was rather which paper was the most absorbent for sopping up spills and which paper was the most repellent to use the way you or I would use wax paper to wrap a sandwich and contain the grease. And so the world that we're living in now of a kind of disembodied virtual relation to words, it seems to me, is not really a result of the digital turn. I think you can trace that disembodiment or increasingly virtual relation to words back further to the end of the 19th century and to the emergence of paper so cheap that you could throw it away, you could scribble on it, you didn't need to carefully smooth out its folds and think about what future use you would put that old newspaper to.
Wow, it's so weird to think about the paper in that term, but I mean, you know, that's what the uses were. You mentioned wrapping vegetables in newspapers, and I wanted to come back to a point that you make in your book about messages that books give without intending to do so. You spend about a page and a half on a book called Vegetable Cookery. What was the irony in the printing of that book?
So this was one of the earliest vegetarian cookbooks. And I have to say, to me, none of the recipes seem terribly appealing because this is British vegetarianism before British people found out about the wonderful soybean. So there is a lot of tapioca pudding and suet custard in this cookbook. However, what I think is interesting about this cookbook that is held in the New York Public Library and is stained with batter and traces of lentils from centuries past is that if you bracket for a minute the words that the cookbook contains and look just at the physical object, it is made from the bodies of animals. The glue in this cookbook would have been made from the bones of broken down horses. The binding is made of animal skin. Everything about this book is very decidedly not vegan. And so often, as when, for example, the constitution of a new nation is written on paper imported from the mother country, the physical form of a book clashes with the verbal message that it contains.
Yeah, very much so. A book basically made of animal parts, telling people to not eat, or how to have a diet that doesn't include animal parts. It's a bit of a contradiction in terms there. In general, Leah, as you look at the attitudes that people take toward printed matter, are you telling people to basically get over themselves, that however somebody chooses to read, browse, sample, or ignore text is totally up to each individual?
I hope that I'm not saying get over yourself. I think what I'm trying to say is relax, that the written word has survived and in fact thrived on change and development, and in particular, the written word has often thrived on messy, complicated ecologies in which a lot of different formats are jostling for space with one another, and one is being used in one context, another is being used in another context, one is being used to signal seriousness, another is being used for convenience on the road, yet another one is being used for display on the coffee table. And so, yes, I don't think that I don't think that the history of the book supports any linear narrative in which once the book was great and now the book is dying, because there is no linear narrative within the history of reading. There is just a lot of zigzagging, confusing trial and error, choosing among different kinds of book for different purposes.
One of the points you make is that you call books the first social media, and I think we've covered some of this already. The fact that people used to read them aloud in pubs, newspapers, things like that. Where do you see it going in that sense in the future? Are people trying to restore that role, that social media role of books?
Yes, I think that the sharing of books is a tremendously valuable form of social glue. If you think of something like the Gideons, who stand at street corners distributing Bibles, if you think of all the ways in which public libraries have acted, especially in the United States, as a kind of common civic space where people of different social classes, people of different races, people of differently documented status touch the same books, sit on the same chairs, sit at the same tables. This, I think, is a tremendously powerful force for a common civic life. And this is true even when people are not reading the same books.
All right. There's a lot to pick up in the book that that talks about not just the literary end of things, which comes from the English professor's side of Leah Price's brain, but also about the conveyances themselves, which comes from the book historian side of Leah Price's brain. We get both for the price of one in the book, What We Talk About When We Talk About Books, The History and Future of Reading. Leah Price, thanks for joining us on The Exchange.
Thanks so much for having me.
Take care.